Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future.
Welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast, an island of insanity, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulos. This is an amazing podcast, really, the best. You're gonna love this, guaranteed, 100%. We are gonna make podcasting great again, promise. And now, my dad, Athanasios, aka Saki Christoulos.
Hey, hello, welcome back after a 3 or 4 month hiatus. I have a good excuse. I had to work, I had a lot of work. I did some work at the federal police in Mexico, and that took up a heck of my time. And that's why it hasn't been since March that I did an episode, but now I did an episode, and it's on security and the victory of López Obrador, the new president of Mexico, dear leader, honorable leader, and in the context of my upcoming 20th anniversary with my wife, Mariana Becerra, a Mexican, by the way, so she can openly give you her opinion about our upcoming president. Mariana, what do you think of Calderón? Sorry, Calderón, López Obrador. They're all the same.
I don't know what to say. It was a very surprising result. I guess it's time for him for the left to win.
We try with PRI. He's a Chavería.
There's a lot of hope in Mexico for him. Because all the other previous governments were so corrupt and so many bad things were done that.
And
we have nothing to lose.
This guy's going to do everything, right?
And the thing is, we thought the same thing in 2000 when Fox won and nothing happened. So Mexico is stuck with bad governments no matter what color they are.
Yeah. You know the party. You know he was in the PRI, right?
That's the thing. We get hopes every 6 years when a new president comes. And the same thing happens again. But we keep thinking and we don't lose hope.
But isn't he like a dinosaur? Like, doesn't he sound like a Chavería, you know, nationalism?
Not really, because since 2000, his main objective has been to abolish corruption.
So
for 18 years, he's been saying the thing, and people know it.
And he did such an awesome...
I think he has a responsibility to
fight
corruption.
And he did such an awesome job of doing that when he was mayor of the city.
He did better than other governors, yes.
Okay, so the song that I picked that you can hear in the background, it's called Where Are All the Cowboys. Do you think this is an appropriate song for López Obrador?
He's the cowboy that's gonna come save us. Well, that's what think, but there's gonna be a big disappointment.
Realistic. Just to wrap this up really quickly, the person that I interviewed, his name is Eric Olson. He's from the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. And he always refers to as López Obrador as Andrés Manuel in the interview, which makes me think they're homies. I didn't ask him. I didn't realize it until I re-listened to the interview. So I think Olsen and Andrés Manuel are big buddies.
Who knows? I'm not that worried because there's a lot of smart people that are next to López Obrador, and that gives me hope.
After 20 years, am I not your cowboy?
Yes, you are.
Okay, I love you.
I love you too.
Okay, so now on to the podcast with Eric Olson. Thank you, Mariana, for being here.
A pleasure. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Eric, I've been reading your stuff for a decade now, and Eric is one of the primary experts on bilateral security relations between Mexico and the United States. And he's written multiple articles, books, edited volumes, which are all, by the way, required reading in my security course. Not all, most, many. In my course on international security, when you get to the part about U.S.-Mexico and like, I have this like diplomado also, which is like everything. All your PDFs are there. So, that's the great thing about Wilson, because you can just like, you know, get them off PDFs. And what I was going to do was, with your permission, of course, I was going to ask you if you wouldn't mind if I put a couple examples on the webpage as the actual PDF, so the listener can download.
Absolutely. I mean, all our stuff is, we only produce publicly available stuff, and it's free to anyone. So I appreciate you letting me know, but you have a right to.
You told me you're in the Latin America program now.
I split my time. I used to be only in the Mexico Institute.
Yeah.
In 2013, which is a little over 5 years now, I began to split my time between the Latin American program, which does pretty much everything else except for Mexico, and we have a special Brazil Institute as well. But I continue to...
Is that an area that you cover as well? What? I mean, Brazil, South America?
Personally, I don't.
I see.
But we have a Brazil Institute that does, akin to the Mexico Institute, with a specialized focus. My colleague and I, Cindy Artson, and we've just brought on a new person, Benjamin Gadan, kind of cover the rest of the region. And I continue to work with the Mexico Institute on Mexico stuff, just because I've always done Mexico.
So it's you, Seeley, and Duncan that are basically
started there, it was just me and Seeley, and then he had a few other fellows. It's grinding and stuff. So now he's the president of the Migration Policy Institute, which is perfect for him.
Okay, so here's my first question. You're a security guy. What are you doing here during an election? I mean, what's... Is that a fair question?
Yeah, very fair. I mean, it's two answers. You know, I don't only do security, and sometimes we do political analysis as well, so that's part of it. But I think, you know, the way I've approached these elections the last two for sure, has been to try to monitor and check, you know, how the discussion and the campaigns around security is playing out and what candidates are really saying about security. And I think it's, you know, campaigns are always light on detail. Yeah. So it's not surprising that there hasn't been a lot. But it's interesting also in this case that violence was one of the top three issues for sure. Some people think it was the issue, but it was certainly on people's minds. The other element, of course, is, you know, this kind of, well, this very alarming growth in the murders of people running for office, people in office. What does this mean? I mean, is there a political agenda here from the criminal groups? My sense overall is there's not a political agenda in a traditional sense. They're not trying to develop a political party. There's no national platform they're running on. They're not particularly interested in overseeing the education system or the water system.
They see these candidates as threats.
Yeah, I as I looked at it, they are all, you know, local candidates, you know, either what in Mexico we call municipal presidents or, you know, city council members, or a couple were from the state legislature, but I don't mean to put it down, but these aren't the big national candidates, these are local. And I think one of the things that makes you think about is what's happening at the local level here. And I think much of the conflict and much of the growth in violence is over what's going on at the local level. People, at least in the United States, sometimes talk about criminal insurgencies and have this sort of view of this as a war, and people can easily slip into sort of almost thinking as a guerrilla war, the government versus these people.
I think of Colombia, right?
They think of Colombia, sure. I think that goes on a real lot, and I personally don't think that's what's happening. You know, I think we need to look very much more carefully. No. There's clearly violence happening. clearly, you know, this was a record number of politicians killed in the lead up to this election. It happened in a broader context of record homicides anyway.
Right.
So in some ways it wouldn't be surprising. But I also think it's that criminal organizations at the local level are fighting for control of piso, as we say, you know, the territory.
Right.
And politicians are either, you know, compliant and reach an arrangement with them,
right,
or they don't. Or there are also cases where, let's say, a mayor of a town has reached an agreement with one group, and then the territory is challenged by the other group. And so the mayor is seen as part of the other criminal group, and we need to take them out. So there's a lot of scenarios going on at the local level. To me, here's the worrisome thing about this. I sense that this is the erosion of state control on the margins of society. We can sit here in Mexico City or Monterey and feel safe, and it's a beautiful place and thriving and modern. But out in the countryside, in these remote areas of Guerrero, Michoacan, Oaxaca, Guerrero and Oaxaca had the two highest, they're the states with the two highest numbers of politicians killed. And as we know, those states are erupting with conflict at the local level between small or large criminal groups. And I don't think that the current security strategies of the previous administration or the current administration, hopefully in the next administration, but we don't know, or of the U.S., think about that.
I was about to ask you, it sounds as though what you're saying is that the problem isn't nationwide. It isn't necessarily something that the federal government can manage on its own. It's something that it needs to work with the states and even the local authorities. And the real weakness maybe isn't so much at the federal level, but at the state and local level. Is that
fair? I think absolutely. I think that's absolutely the case. It doesn't mean the federal government in Mexico or any other country has no role to play, but their instruments, their tools are pretty, you know, blunt instruments that can't help rebuild state control at the local level. So you have the situation in Michoacan where they deploy the military because of extreme violence. We get it. We understand it. Maybe the only logical thing, deploy the military, try to settle things down. Maybe you know, criminal groups go into the shadows or whatnot. But the military's ability, the ability of the federal police to rebuild the state institutions at the local level is zero.
It's zero.
Yeah. And no one
is. It's just not their mission.
It's not their mission. And it's as if neither the U.S. nor Mexico nor anybody else has thought about, well, how are we going to do that part of it?
Right.
We can break up the big groups. We can push them aside momentarily. But they continue to dominate locally, even though the state may be present because there's a battalion or group of military people on the corner in the middle of the town. They're not really in control because they don't control the municipal president. They don't control all the criminal activity going on in that area. And that kind of micro level is one that's not entirely understood, and it's certainly not taken into account in policy design, either in the U.S. or Mexico.
I mean, that kind of leads us into the new internal security law, which for those of you who don't know, is a law that essentially deputizes the armed forces of the country when it's necessary to declare some kind of emergency, but they don't do security sector reform.
No.
Right? And that's what these areas need. That's what this country needs. Or sector or public sector reform, period. And what I've been telling, I have problems with this law for a number of reasons, but one thing that I've been trying to tell the military here is that, that, you know, don't feel bad. You're going to fail at this, but don't feel bad, because if you look globally at UN attempts to try to do security sector reform, sending peacekeepers, sending Canadians, or sending most of these efforts have, almost all of these efforts in the post-Cold War period have failed. So having the armed forces of a country do security sector reform is just a non-starter. But what do you think about the law in general?
Well, I think there are several causes, cause concern on several fronts. I think Mexico still has not resolved the issue of holding military accountable in a civilian justice system for human rights violations.
It's not going to happen now with this law.
I think that's the concern. I mean,
that's why the law exists.
That they wanted a clear legal authority to do what they're going to do. And in theory, those things should be always subsumed to the international agreements that Mexico has signed and agreed to abide by. Mm-hmm. But we know in practice that's extraordinarily hard. It would take a civilian that would say, no, I'm going to hold the military, I'm going to hold the local general accountable for these kinds of violations. It theoretically can happen. Mm-hmm. There's no reason legally they couldn't do it. It just doesn't happen. It's much more complicated. You know, we have this problem in the United States too. You know, it's hard to hold militaries accountable when they violate the law. I'm sure Canada and the U.S. has somewhat of a track record in this area, but Mexico certainly has not. So I am worried about that, but I'm also worried that this law, you know, defines their role in such a way that has limited reach and is really not addressing these local problems of governance. I don't want the military. I don't think we're asking that the military address those, but it sort of becomes an end in itself. We've solved this one. The military now has this role, and it's not addressing the bigger problems.
So what would you do then, locally?
Well,
I mean, other than this big thing called security sector reform.
Right. Well, you know, we did a bit of an exercise a couple years ago trying to think about where has there been successful experiences in restoring some semblance of order and state control, and you know, all of those experiences in Latin America are urban. You know, they're local experiences. Probably the most famous one is Medellin. Medellin still has problems. I think we all acknowledge there's still problems in Medellin, but it's worlds apart. What did they do in Medellin? That was a very interesting approach. Tremendous support from the international community. But the federal role was defined and limited. The state and local people also had a role. And it's not all about having police and throwing people in jail. Mm-hmm. It's about being able to complement law enforcement with the needed social programs and social investments. Even it's into issues such as urban design. I don't want to suggest urban design is the solution, but when you look at particular hotspots and you think about it from an urban design point of view, you can make changes that limit the risk that people face in those particular areas. So my point really is not we all need to become urban planners, but we need to bring together all these various levels of government to focus on solving a local and a specific problem. And that, in the case of Mexico, will be very hard.
Because, I was just going to say.
Yeah, because it's a huge country.
It would be impossible to.
It could be, but I think if you choose, you know, one or two tactically and really try to apply these, you know, I think it would be helpful.
But you'd have to start with, like you just said, one or two things to begin with. Let's say, what would be like the one thing that you would start with, or you would try to start with, at a local level?
Well, I would choose, let's say, I mean, for the sake of argument, you could choose Acapulco,
which is,
you know, highly violent, or you could choose somewhere like Ciudad Juarez.
Okay, so you start with Acapulco, and what do you do?
And you do a full analysis of what's the real problem here. It has to be deeper than simply it's drug trafficking or it's gangs, you know. Where is violence taking place and what is happening specifically in those areas? So a better analysis, you know, you can call it intelligence analysis, something that's more holistic in its approach. And then design a strategy that defines roles for law enforcement, because we know law enforcement's a necessary component, but it's never the end in itself. You know, it's one element that has to be complemented with other things. Of good and effective prosecution, holding people accountable, not just the low-hanging fruit, the guy on the corner selling a bag of marijuana to a tourist, but really who are the players and the actors here.
The perception here, though, is that since they've implemented judicial reforms towards a adversarial type legal system, is that it's failed because all these people are being let loose because of the way they collected evidence and so forth.
Right. And I think then you get into sort of even bigger problems. And I agree. I personally think it was the right move.
Yeah,
it was maybe overly ambitious to do it at the whole country level. They kind of did it, even though they had this 8 years for transformation, a lot of it didn't happen until the last year with insufficient resources. So there are a lot of things to learn there. But I think unless you have the tools at your disposal, all these tactics are going to be very, very limited in their impact. There, conceptually, there's the writings, there's a whole line of thought here that's called focused deterrence, which tries to really understand the local elements of conflict, violence, and how to approach it in a specific way. Mm-hmm. We have an overbroad narrative in Mexico and the United States and other places. Just to point a finger at the United States, this notion that immigrants represent a security threat.
Mm-hmm.
That means you have to check all immigrants as a potential threat. Mm-hmm. We know that's ridiculously expensive and inefficient. So it's all trying to, where do you focus your efforts? What are the elements that you're trying to solve? And you approach it that way, kind of almost from the bottom up. And I know that's a long-term process for this country, but they haven't had much success here in the last 20 years. So continuing to do this thing is not going to help.
Yeah, and this law just is a continuation of a failed policy.
Exactly.
Somebody once told me, some Canadian official once told me that the problem here isn't so much money. It isn't that Mexico lacks resources.
Right.
It's that there's a lack of political will.
Yeah.
To make the changes. And political will included things like corruption.
Yeah.
Wouldn't, let's say, corruption be a good start? Or
right. Yeah, no, I agree. At some level, we have to kind of also find, I don't know what the right word is, almost the original sin here. What is the thing that's making all
this? But it's that, isn't it? It's corruption.
I keep coming back to that, to be honest with you. That's why, in my work in Central America, there are a lot of things that one needs to look at, but one of the elements of it that's so key is the anti-corruption efforts. Now, Guatemala and Honduras have made some unusual steps and invited the international community in to play a role to combat corruption because the institutions are so weakened that they can't heal themselves.
Right.
They need outside help. And so that's what's been going on.
Do you think Mexico's like that?
I certainly believe that's a wonderful question. I don't know that I have the exact answer. My sense is that sort of at a national level, they do have the capacity if there's the political will.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure at all the local levels, where the state prosecutor's offices and the local municipal police are really rotten through to the core. There's nothing that they're going to do on their own. That's going to turn.
It's not only that they're rotten; it's that they're poorly trained.
Well, that's what I mean. I don't mean they're rotten people, but I mean they're just
some of them are rotten people.
Well, that's true. But the institutions themselves have been so hollowed out by corruption and crime and so on that you can't expect them to heal themselves. It's just impossible.
This will never happen. But what about a federal police for Mexico, but only that one federal police that is in charge of the entire country? It won't happen for obvious reasons, but
there's been a lot of talk about this.
Mando Unico,
Mando Unico, a single command. Here's my feeling about it is it simply rearranging reporting, you know, that the local police now are reporting to the federal police or being subsumed doesn't get at the core problems, right? It doesn't get at the core problems that the local police, whether they're local, responsible
but
for
I mean,
the municipality.
Replacing them with federal police.
Well, okay, so that would be an alternative view. Now, here's the other thing. I hate to sound like such a negative, trying to want to find concrete and good solutions. That could be a possibility, but, you know, Mexico and other countries, it's not so easy to simply go out and find good people standing around that want to join them. You know, you have to train them. First, you have to select them, right? You have to know that they're physically, mentally, and they have no criminal background. You have to select people with certain skills. Then you have to train them. And the tendency in many countries is to give them 3 months and send them out on their own. A year is minimum.
Yeah, that takes a lot of federal time. Police have an 11-month, not quite sure.
I think the federal police are at that level, and that's great. To do that for the 400 and some thousand other police in the country, because the federal police are, what, in the area of 40,000?
At best.
At best. That's a tremendous undertaking. Now, I don't say you shouldn't try to do it. They should be doing this. But I think people are generally overwhelmed. What's the transition plan here? You have local police who are untrained, often corrupt, have no support or backing. And then you want to have a well-trained. That could be a 3, 4, 5-year proposition at best. So what's the transition? I think you can think about those things. We should think about those things. But no administration seems to want to be the one to commit to it. And that probably gets back to your political will question.
There's talk about bringing back the Ministry of Public Safety or the
Security.
Public Security.
Or, yeah.
Sorry, Canadian. Public Safety. Do you think that would make... Is that going to make a difference?
You know, at a kind of meta level, yes, I think it's important because when it's under Gobernación, the Interior Ministry, which is a political... At the end, they have political responsibility. I think it puts the police in a political context. And by separating it and creating a civilian, independent police that should be nonpartisan, right? It should be about fighting crime. I think it's better. Now, again, these aren't panaceas. Calderon tried it. I think Fox was moving in that direction. You know, I think it has benefits, but, you know, it's not a panacea either.
All right, so that brings us to the new president. What do you think? What do you think of him and his plan?
Well,
the country as far as security is concerned.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things I've been hearing the last few days is that Andrés Manuel, the new president, didn't define a policy plan. I frankly think that's unrealistic. As I recall, in the 2012 election, that Enrique Peña Nieto won, his policy plan was to not talk about security.
Right.
He talked about turning the page, emphasizing other things. So, you know, candidates have a way of talking about something without really telling him a whole hell of a lot.
And he's talked about coming to some kind of agreement with the groups. He had to pull back on that because for obvious reasons. But
right, so he signaled
Have you seen any kind of coherent security agenda for him?
Not yet, and as I understand it, that's where they are now to try to work that out. And Mexico has, you know, what is kind of an unusually long transition period from now until December 1st, I believe, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's time to sit down and start to really hash out these things. They've set out, and Andrés Manuel set out some broad parameters and issues that he wants to focus on. And so it gives us some insight, but it's not an actual security plan. Some of those things are interesting and could be useful and helpful. Mm-hmm. Others is worrisome because there's just no information, right? There's just nothing there. You mentioned the issue, he got beat up on this issue of amnesty. Mm-hmm. He was probably overly broad and a little bit careless in how he talked about it, and people started thinking he was talking about amnesty for everybody, even the big, you know,
bosses.
In retrospect, and as he kind of tried to define it, he wanted to talk much more about the small. You know, much of the poppy production, for instance, in Mexico, happens, you know, in very rural areas campesinos, you know, small farmers have 5, 6, 10 poppy plants that they use to supplement their income. These aren't hardened, you know, criminal masterminds bringing heroin into Toronto or Washington, D.C. And it would be, again, it would be, you know, to prosecute every campesino who has a handful of poppy trees would be enormously inefficient and probably have very little impact overall. So I think there's some wisdom, he needs to just have. But police forces in the United States, and I'm sure in Toronto, they tend to, you know. No, I think the basic notion is that resources being stretched thin should focus on the important players and not simply the low-hanging fruit. Because in many cases in Latin America and in Mexico, up to 40% of prisoners are in prison, you know, for some really minor drug-related offense. Yeah. You know, I'm not saying Mexico or the U.S. should turn a blind eye to these things. They are serious. But, you know, let's go after the serious issues. Throwing all these people in jail and prosecuting them doesn't address the problems locally that are driving the overall crime.
What about going after the money?
Going after the money is a big priority, and in fact, if you look...
I mean, in just going after the money, or prioritizing the issue of money laundering, which is essentially what drives this whole thing, at least in my mind.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, if you look at the policy documents that the Trump administration has issued on its security strategy, especially in the context of fighting transnational organized crime, fighting money laundering is key, central to that. They talk about moving away from a kingpin strategy to a strategy of attacking the business model. This is the language they use. Now, people use language and it doesn't reflect in policy or practice, but they are trying to focus a good bit on this money aspect. And I think if...
How about Mexico? How?
Well, I think this is one of the challenges. Mexico has made some progress on this front, but there's a lot more to be done. We had a meeting yesterday with an international banker, head of one of the biggest international banks here in Mexico City. And they have dealt with some issues related to money laundering and had to put in place practices to fight money laundering amongst their depositors here in Mexico and their clients, you know, in infrastructure and so on. But he says, you know, very few banks in Mexico do this. The standards aren't clear. They're not adopting them. So the possibility of money laundering, and even more so than money laundering, but the use of federal funds for infrastructure for the big mega projects as a way of capturing all kinds of government resources is a big problem because the banking system is weak.
All right, so going back to Lobos Obrador, I mean, if you had a crystal ball and you could see what's going to happen in the next 6 years as far as, the security situation in Mexico, what's your best bet? And I know it's a horribly difficult question, but sorry.
I mean, I think what we need to see...
Is this a good thing? Essentially what I'm asking you is it a good thing that Lobos Obrador won the election as far as the issue of security is concerned versus, let's say, Anaya or me?
Yeah, let me just say it this way. It could be a good thing if he and his team, probably more importantly, are willing to take a fresh look at these issues, and are willing to bring in, you know, knowledgeable people to think anew about the problems of security in Mexico. If the tendency is, which happened with Peña Nieto, they just fall naturally and easily back in the same old, because you can say, oh, we caught this guy, we caught that guy, and it looks like success, then I think the next 6 years could be bloody. There will be up and downs, of course, but no significant change in the overall dynamic. And that's what worries me. Mm-hmm. So there are this. I prefer to think about this.
Sorry, I missed that. You're worried that the next government is not going to implement the policies that you're suggesting that might be helpful.
Yes, that's the risk that we, you know, that they're overcome by, you know, other pressures, and the process of rethinking strategy. Security strategy is hard and arduous, and you don't always get political points for it, that they simply fall back into what is well known. And clearly the police, the military in Mexico like this approach because it puts them at the center. But I think what we saw in the elections is people are not convinced that it's really working and helping. So I'd like to think about this as an opportunity to rethink. I don't have all the answers, but you could get together with 20 top thinkers and work through this and listen to people and come up with something different. And so let's be hopeful for the moment.
Populists don't have a particularly good record.
Yeah. I agree. But let's be hopeful for the minute.
He sounds, I'll say this, he looks and sounds a lot like Echeverria. I mean, this nationalist, leftist populist.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing that worries me about...
partly anti-American, or to some extent, and I think that's going to come out much more as things move along.
One thing that worries me about his security strategy is he's talked a great deal of social investment and dealing with the needs of young people.
Yeah.
That's clearly an element of a strategy. You know, we know there are tens of thousands, even millions of young people without access to education, without access to jobs. Yes, that has to be part of it. But that's a long-term proposition as well. And I think you have to have an idea about what you want to do with law enforcement.
Look, a lot of the problems, a lot of the violence in the country tends to be in the regions of the country that are wealthier, where you do have better education and better opportunities, like in the north of the country versus the south.
Yes.
The kids that are joining these gangs aren't the street kids that, well, they're street kids, but you know what I mean. They're not the starving people who have not gone to school. They're maybe the dropouts from high school, but they did have access to...
Well, the most homicidal, the states with the highest number of homicides are really rural, poor states. But Guerrero, Oaxaca, Michoacan, and up that Pacific Coast Rim.
Okay.
Now, there are some exceptions to that rule. One of the stunning things that we need to think about is that 1 out of 10 murders in Mexico last year occurred in Tijuana. Tijuana is a rich, prosperous, thriving, modern city.
One out of ten.
What is going on in Tijuana?
Well,
I would refer you, because I don't want to take credit for things that I haven't done, but refer you to the work of David Shirk, who's at the University of San Diego. You know him, I'm sure. Yeah. Has done some really close look at this. He and Octavio Rodriguez and a handful of others. And, you know, what they say is that, you know, there's an underlying simmering conflict over control of that territory and access into the United States. And what the criminal groups have gotten better in quotes here, because it's not a good thing, they have, you know, backed away from the, you know, kind of horrific symbolic violence that was going on there in 2009, 2010, where people were being beheaded and hung from, you know, bridges and all that kind of gross, extreme stuff. They're more violent than they were back then. They're just using different forms of violence. Violence has become much more strategic, much more focalized. David even says, you know, people are murdered, you know, 2 or 3 people in a very poor neighborhood, and there are actually people that come by and pick up the body and clean up. And these are not state or local authorities doing that. These are criminal groups. So they're sort of they've learned new strategies of how to be violent without being so central in the focus. And I think maybe, and this is a theory on my part, is they understand that to do that, you know, the authorities in the U.S. and the Mexican may focus on them a little bit less. And to the extent that Tijuana is a prosperous city with world-class restaurants and businesses, also new targets for extortion for them. I mean, they're involved in all kinds of illegal activity.
Why has Mexico City, all of a sudden, in this sexenio, become all of a sudden a place where violence has increased after it had dropped in the 90s and the 2000s?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very good question, and I'm not sure I know. I mean, Mexico City's obviously really at the, the crossroads to much of the traffic of this country.
It was kind of illicit.
But it had remained outside of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe in part, I mean, some of the theories was that a lot of criminals lived here and they didn't want it.
Yeah.
There might be multiple explanations. You know, the Mexico City police are better and stronger than a lot of places, you know, comparable to Monterrey and Guadalajara. That may have helped. Maybe there's something that's changed about that. Maybe that's not as true anymore as it once was. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is to that question exactly.
What about Mexico-U.S. cooperation? Going forward.
Yeah.
Are you worried about it?
I am. I am worried. I think, you know, there's two different things going on over the last 20 years, let's say. There's been these growing ties and linkages between law enforcement, prosecutors, sort of at the real operational level, that have gone, and military. The military, it's been surprising.
Especially Marina.
But even Sedena has not entirely taken a back seat. They've done more and more together. There's more intelligence sharing than ever before. There's a whole sort of network of connections that have developed over time. That have been beneficial, I think, to both sides. And I think overall, all those institutions are deeply committed to that kind of cooperation going forward.
The institutions themselves, the people who are there. But
the problem now is you have a president in the United States who, one, is not as familiar with those issues and has a whole another way of approaching his job. And is not necessarily thinking, in my estimation, about the potential damage that can be done by a simple tweet, by annoying the Mexicans, by saying things that are perceived here as deeply insulting. I think at some level...
But now you got a situation where you have two potential hotheads.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I always see Amlo in the same way as we see Donald Trump. However, I think the point you're making is a valid one. I don't think Amlo is inclined to, you know, sort of turn another cheek, right? He's more inclined to hit back and push back. I don't think that Andrés Manuel is, I think a lot of us know him, is deeply focused on Mexico, and he wants to really focus on that. And to the extent the relationship to the United States is not a problem for him, doesn't create, you know, a drag on him, what he wants to do, and he's not being insulted, I think he will probably leave well enough alone.
So he wouldn't touch, you don't think he would, for whatever other reason than what you just mentioned, he would... mess around with the mechanisms of cooperation that have evolved over. Because he has been a little bit with flag waving kind of stuff, the whole...
Yes, thing. He has. But so far, when you talk to people in the bureaucracies, in the institutions, they say, no signs, we're not being... because that happened in the case of Peña Nieto.
It did.
Peña Nieto famously put on hold for a whole year to the point that the U.S. people were going out of their minds. And then when they restored their relationship, it was through what they called the ventanilla única, you know, a single window approach. We were asking people yesterday about that, and they said, there's no sign that he wants to return to that kind of a controlled situation. Now, if the debate in the United States leading up to the November elections turns on the issue of the wall and migration and attacks against Mexico, I would not be surprised if he didn't say, look, let's pull back.
Wouldn't it make sense for López Obrador to just keep his mouth shut for now?
Well, I think yeah, tactically that's true, but he also would run the risk of being seen by his electorate as passive in front of the attacks from Trump.
So, and in the end, that's important, right? I mean, he's gonna have
to be passive.
Well, he's gonna have to respond.
He's gonna have to respond. That's what I mean.
Much more than, let's say, someone like Calderón or maybe even Peña Nieto.
So I guess what I'm saying here is that I don't see AMLO, you know, starting his administration by saying we're going to really cut back with on the U.S. assistance.
All right.
However, his hand may be forced. It may be politically unviable for him to maintain that posture if the lobs keep coming from the White House. If there's, you know, the rhetoric, the tweets, I think that's a risk.
Do you think? You know, the tweet that Trump sent the other day, the phone call, they seem to be quite nice towards López Obrador.
I think at this stage they're both trying to play nice.
Yeah.
I think that's the right approach. That's a good first signal. But I think we've all, and I know many Republicans in Congress say, we cannot predict nor control what the president's going to tweet. So let's hope, knock on wood, fingers crossed, that this kind of willingness to be understanding and work together persists. But, you know, we need to be prepared for it, possibly not.
So you're thinking, just to make it clear in my head, that López Obrador by himself wouldn't have any need to touch whatever has been evolving over the last 10 or 12 years unless something happens vis-a-vis the wall or NAFTA negotiations or something like that, or some kind of bizarre tweet from coming out of the White House.
Yeah, and I think the other element here is the migration. I mean, the points you're making are the sore spots, potential sore spots. Mm-hmm. The other issue is migration. The U.S. has now, because they're detaining Central Americans for so much longer time, and there's so much of a buildup, is now in a position of having to, or have made the decision that they need to return Mexicans more quickly. And so what were prior agreements about repatriating Mexicans, you know, on a flight to Mexico City or inland, they're back to the old policy of dumping people across the border.
Mm-hmm.
That creates a lot of problems for Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes those deportations happen in the middle of the night, and there are security risks with that. I'm hopeful, I don't know one way or the other, but I'm hopeful the U.S. is still at least telling Mexico, you know, of this busload of 30 people, this one guy is actually a real serious criminal, not just a guy who came in illegally, but, you know, actually committed a murder or did something very serious, so that Mexico can take the needed steps. That was the arrangement they had up to about 5 months ago. But the U.S. has begun to, you know, go back on that. So I guess what I'm saying is, yes, the wall's an issue, NAFTA's an issue, but there are other issues, too, that could create such problems for Mexico and Andrés Manuel that he wants to pull back on other stuff.
Why is Trump, I missed this because I was in Europe, so I have a good excuse, but why has Trump pushed back the renegotiation of NAFTA until after the elections, after the midterms?
Well, I mean, there's two answers to that. One is, it's in all likelihood, you know, even if they negotiate from every day from now until November, it's probably when they would get done anyway. So in some ways, it's nothing. It's no news. It just takes long. They have a lot of things to do.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think we all understand that he sees this as a political tool in his the campaigns that are upcoming, the midterm. He's not on the ballot, but he wants strong Republican support in Congress. There's some fear that they may lose control of one or both houses. So this is a strong motivator to his base as well. There's certainly a political reason of this decision.
But coming up with a deal, wouldn't that help him in the midterms?
I think if he thought he was going to get the kind of deal that he could sell as a real, you know, win for the U.S., maybe, probably. But he also sees this as a thing that fires up his base, that he's being tough, holding the line, and, you know, making the Mexicans squirm. Again, since we're in this transition period now here in Mexico, I find it highly unlikely that they would reach a deal between now and November if everything was working smoothly.
Okay, one last question, and because I've taken way too much of your time. is there just so much uncertainty right now in the bilateral relationship that it's way too difficult to make any kind of predictions as to which direction it's going to go? And the risk is that it can go either way.
I think what I would say slightly different. We're at a crossroads, and it could definitely go very badly. It also is an
opportunity. Could we go back? I mean, to the bad old days of, you know.
Yeah, in fact, I see it emerging every once in a while, you know, this finger pointing. Mexicans are not doing enough. Mm-hmm. And the Mexicans feel like, well, geez, you guys are the ones consuming all these drugs. You know, why is this our problem? You know, you slip back into that mode pretty quickly. So I think it's a risk. I'd rather think about it as an opportunity here, that if both sides put their best feet forward, calm down the rhetoric, and also try to think creatively about ways to work together. We could do a lot more on the anti-money laundering stuff. There's no question about that. You raised that earlier. I think the U.S. could be really helpful to Mexico on the corruption stuff. We know that these governors took a lot of their money to the U.S., bought big houses in cash. The U.S. has taken steps to make that impossible. You can't buy, you know, huge real estate in cash any longer. It's just legally not possible. In border states, I mean, it's still possible in other parts. The U.S. could do more and could put forward offer to others. You want on an anti-corruption ticket, we want to help you. Here are things we can do to help you be successful. I think there are ways they could work together on the immigration side as well, because there's no question there are some serious issues there.
They can, but the issues will.
Will they? Yeah, and that's the question on all these things. So I don't want to be a pessimist that says this is going, you know, bad from bad to worse. It's inevitable. I think there's some real risks, but let's keep talking positive and try to give good ideas.
Basically saying, like, give good vibes and find hope there.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think part of it is to remind policymakers that there are alternatives, right? No. I hear you. I mean, I don't want to be Pollyannish about it either and, oh, it's all wonderful. But I do feel it's our responsibility as the Wilson Center to come up with creative and positive ideas that can help build this relationship. If not, then we're condemned to really a difficult time.
All right. So, sorry, one last question. What, and it's your fault because you made me think of it right now. What's the agenda for Wilson going forward
on
the Mexico-U.S. Relationship? What are the things that you're going to be working on?
Well, we're working on some policy papers that we're going to present to the transition team, some ideas around security.
Okay.
I think we have the same obligation with our own side, both in Congress and the Trump administration, that actually, you know, does what I said, which is to put forward the kind of constructive ideas that are attainable. We're not just throwing out wild-eyed ideas of, you know, legalization of everything and, you know, kumbaya, and we're all wonderful. But I think that's the role we can play. And in a bigger sense, I think the Mexico Institute's role and Wilson Institute's role is to help both sides be a little more familiar and less likely to make erroneous judgments about the other.
Lopez Obrador was there.
Yes, he was.
Did he have a good time? Is what I'm asking.
Well, I don't know. You'd have to ask him. I think it was a very successful. Look, I'll tell you. In 2012, when he ran, I invited him. He came, mm-hmm. and we held it in our auditorium. And there was probably, 120 people there. We broadcast it. Some of more people, but this time, mm-hmm. when we announced it, our RSVPs, our people mm-hmm. signing up, went up to 800 within mm-hmm. minutes.
Wow.
So we suddenly scrambled to find a new auditorium. So I think that he definitely was viewed as a more serious player now. He was extraordinarily cautious because it was pre-campaign period. He didn't want to,
stick. I noticed that.
I wouldn't say it was a dynamic yeah. exchange of ideas.
I listened to it and it was
plotting, and
he was kind of resistant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Didn't want to go.
Right. I would hope that, it's always an open door for us at the Wilson Center, that he would come back and have an opportunity to really introduce himself now as president to Washington and the United States mm-hmm. and put forward his agenda. Because, he didn't really do that as a candidate. That's typical of most candidates and campaigns. But now is the time to start filling in those blanks and helping people understand what it is you're doing.
Excellent, Eric.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, my friend.
Yeah, glad to do it. And congratulations on this blog.
Oh, yeah, it's fun. I'm having fun. Of the shape you left me in.
Listen to the whole song. You'll like it. It was raining. I went down Chippewa Road. I picked it out from the window like a thousand fools before. I got a heart that's torn in two, so everyone can see I'm nothing without. Torn in two. I was talking all about you as if it mattered to him. He sighed and said, I. So everyone can see I'm nothing without you. My heart's been torn in two. Just like you, I gotta burn some gasoline.